chamber, trying to uncover Grianne's hiding place. The glittering specks coated everything, leaving a clear outline of what lay concealed within the shadows and smoke. Grianne Ormsford was nowhere to be found.
"Show yourself, you coward!"
Shadea screamed in fury. "Turn around." Shadea stiffened, and then did so. Grianne Ormsford stood a few yards away against the wall behind Shadea and to the right. She mirrored the wraith that had appeared in the doorway, cloaked and hooded in black, the Eilt Druin clasp at her throat. Her face and hands were pale and ravaged. She looked beaten and tired. She did not look up to a confrontation. Shadea took her measure and recognized the truth. The demon business and the offer of banishment were all a bluff. "You don't look well, Grianne," she said. "You look as if a strong breeze might topple you. I don't imagine it was very pleasant inside the forbidding, was it?" Her enemy said nothing, but those strange blue eyes never left her own. They were watching her, waiting to see which way she would go, whatever else Grianne was. She wasn't a fool. "I think you have come to Paranor for the last time," Shadea continued softly. "I think you have just wasted your one chance at escaping with your life." "Don't mistake what you see," the other whispered. "Take my offer. Go now. Banishment is not the worst of what can happen to you."
"I'll burn your eyes out first," Shadea responded.
"Shadea, wait."
Trant Rowan stepped forward, hands stretched out in a gesture of supplication.
"Enough of this. It's over. We've lost, don't you see?"
"Be silent,"
she hissed.
"To what end? The time for silence is past. Look at what's before us. Anyone who can survive the forbidding and come back alive to the Four Lands and then break free of a Triagonel is no one I care to challenge. If she can do all she has done to get back here and confront us like this, she has magic and luck beyond anything we possess."
He looked at Grianne.
"I told you once that you should resign for the good of the Order. I have not changed my mind about that. I still think you should. I still think you are too divisive to ever bring the Order together in the way that will serve the greater good. I took sides against you because of it. Maybe I was wrong to do so. But I was not wrong about you."
He shook his head. "You must make your own decision. I have made mine.
I accept this offer. I accept banishment. I've had enough."
He gave Shadea a hard, searching look, and she returned it with enough venom to poison a city. But he would not look away, and he did not blink.
"Do the right thing, Shadea. Give it up."
He turned away from her and stalked down the hall, brushing aside a cluster of gnomes that barred his way. Shadea stared after him in disbelief, and then screamed in rage.
"Traitor!"
She sent an explosion of druid fire into his back, white hot and corrosive. The force of the blow lifted him off his feet and flung him against the far wall, where he slid to the floor, a lifeless, burning wreck. In the next instant, Pison Wentz attacked Grianne Ormsford. Kermadec had climbed almost two flights into the keep before he realized Atalan was following him. He wheeled back instantly.
"What are you doing?"
he shouted at his brother in dismay.
"Go back and wait with the others."
Atalan kept coming and shoved past him as if he weren't there.
"Go back yourself, brother."
Kermadec reached for him angrily and then stopped himself. Getting into a fight with his brother would serve no useful purpose. If Atalan wanted to come, it was because he wanted to help. What was the point in being angry with that? The point, he knew, was that he was afraid for Atalan, but he also knew that their relationship was well beyond a time and place where he could do anything about that. He forced his concerns aside, caught up with Atalan, and without looking at him said,
We'll go back together when this business is finished and done with.
They passed knots of druids, who stood looking at them in surprise, books and scrolls cradled in their hands, dark robes gathered close. A few recognized him and nodded. They didn't seem to know what was happening. One or two moved quickly away when they realized he had been in a fight, and he shouted after them to go to the assembly and stay there. He assumed that most of them would. He was still convinced that they would not fight for Shadea if they were not threatened themselves. The hallways came and went as the two rock trolls raced ahead. Only once did they encounter anything resembling resistance, and that was an unexpected run-in with a knot of gnome hunters who fled the moment they saw what they were up against. Kermadec had not been inside the keep in years, but he remembered it well from his time as captain of the Druid Guard, and he found his way without difficulty. Almost all of the gnomes were on the walls, fighting to hold against the onslaught of rock trolls pouring through the north gates. As they neared the upper reaches of the north tower, Kermadec grew increasingly uneasy. He did not like the keep's empty feeling. He did not like the unusual quiet. His battle instincts were finely tuned from years of fighting, and he knew better than to ignore them. There was an edge to his anticipation this time that was unusual. He had the strange sensation of wanting to hurry, and at the same time needing to slow down. Perhaps it was the nature of the mission or what was at stake. Perhaps it was the place and time. He could not explain it, but he did not slow. His concerns must be for his mistress. She had come back to them, he believed. She had escaped the forbidding. The explosion in the north tower told him Penderyn had succeeded. She was there, and he knew in his heart that she needed him. As he neared the upper hallway and the sleeping chamber of the Ard Ris, the sounds of a desperate struggle convinced him that he was right. Grianne Ormsford was caught off guard by Pyson Wentz's attack. She had assumed that any attack would begin with Shadea, to whom the others clearly looked. On coming out of the sleeping chamber and using the false image to distract the druids, she had placed herself in a position where she could best defend herself against the sorceress. She had not forgotten about Pyson or Trond Rowan, but she had focused her attention principally on Shadea. But Shadea's unexpected attack on Trond Rowan had surprised her, and for just a moment she had taken her attention away from the gnome. Perhaps he had been watching for that. His attack came just as she realized the danger, but she was too slow to deflect it entirely. The druid fire slammed into her, nearly shattering her defenses. It scorched her hair and the skin of her face, and if not for the protective magic already in place, including that woven through her druid robes, she would have been incinerated. Even so, the force of the attack knocked her off her feet and sent her sprawling down the hall, tangled in her black robes, furious at herself for her inattention, and desperate to regain control of the situation. She sprang up again, but a second explosion immediately knocked her down once more. Pyson was moving toward her by then, leveling a steady barrage of incendiary magic, trying to keep her down long enough to finish her. She rolled and twisted, using the wall to lever herself back to her knees, and launched her own druid fire in response, but her efforts were weak and unsustained, and the gnome kept advancing. Then Shadea wheeled back, and Grianne was forced to turn her attention to the new threat, lashing out at the sorceress before she had a chance to join the attack. Shadea screamed in fury as the magic of the wish song knocked her backwards. But Shadea was physically much stronger than Grianne and was quick to regain her balance. Within seconds, Grianne was under attack from two sides. Just as it seemed that she had exposed herself too quickly and would pay the price for her impatience, Kermadec came charging down the hallway with a second troll right behind, slamming into a cluster of gnome hunters that tried to slow him, scattering the gnarled figures as if they were made of paper. Roaring with a ferociousness that froze the blood, the big troll went right at Shadea. But Shadea Aru had fought on the Precandoran and was no stranger to hand-to-hand combat. Moreover, she was very nearly as strong as the troll. She met his rush with a howl as ferocious as his own, slipped his grasp, and let his momentum carry him into the wall. Then she wheeled back on him, able to bring her magic to bear now, and sent the druid fire burning into him. Just as she did so, the second troll came at her as well.
Kermadec!
He roared in what seemed more a battle cry than a warning. Down went Shadea Aru and the second troll in a tangled, thrashing knot, rolling over and over on the stone floor. Kermadec was struggling to rise, but Pison Wentz joined the attack, and searing druid fire slammed Kermadec back against the wall, knocking the breath out of him and leaving his thick hide steaming from the heat. The gnome struck at him again and again, shouting for his hunters to move in and finish him. But Pison made the same mistake now with Grian that she had made earlier with him. He forgot about her. She surged to her feet in a white-hot fury, summoned the power of the wish-song, and struck out at him with every ounce of strength she could manage. Sensing his danger, the gnome turned from Kermadec toward her just in time to receive the full brunt of the attack. She had a glimpse of his terrified face as he fought to protect himself. For just a second, his defenses held. Then they fell apart. And Pison Wentz simply exploded. So damaged by the gnome druid's attack that flames were licking at the burned places on his body, Kermadec was trying to get up again.
Adelan!
He called desperately. Shadea Aru broke free of Kermadec's brother, wheeled away, and went into a crouch. When she came out of it, she was holding a long knife at waist level. Adelan came at her fearlessly, his massive arms reaching out to crush her, but she sidestepped him easily in a practiced, fluid movement and drove the knife hilt deep into his chest. Adelan sagged from the blow and dropped to his knees, gasping. Shadea kicked his body aside and turned back to Grian, hands lifting. She attacked anew, sending a hail of druid fire into her enemy. Grian was able to fight off the attack, but only barely. The force of it knocked her backwards once more, and she struggled to keep her feet as she sought to defend herself, trying in vain to mount a counterattack. She felt her defenses crumbling. She felt the heat of the druid fire beginning to break through. Suddenly, out of the corner of her eye, she saw Kermadec, his great body bloodied and steaming, lurched to his feet. One hand grasped a spear he had taken from one of his gnome attackers. Bracing himself against the wall, he gripped the spear in one huge fist, set himself, and heaved it at Shadea. Too late, the sorceress realized the danger. She wheeled to protect herself, but the spear caught her in the chest and drove her back against the wall, the force of the throw pinning her fast. Her body jerked, and her head snapped back. Her eyes went wide with shock and disbelief. She screamed and flailed, trying to break free. She sprayed druid fire everywhere. But the blow was fatal, and a moment later, she collapsed and did not move again. The remaining gnome hunters were already in flight, disappearing down the hallway as fast as they could manage. Grian stood alone among the wounded and the dead. She lowered her hands, dispersed the magic she had summoned to defend herself, and stared at Shadea Aru. The sorceress was staring back at her, eyes blank and unseeing, face twisted in a death mask. Grian looked away, sickened, then walked quickly over to Kermadec. The big rock troll slid down the wall into a sitting position, his chin sunk on his chest, blood and burned patches were everywhere on his massive body. She knelt before him and gently raised his head. "Kermadec," she whispered. "Can you hear me?" His eyes opened and fixed on her.
"Mistress,"
he replied, his voice thin and reedy.
"I told you they were vipers."
She bent forward and kissed his face, and then cradled him against her and whispered, "You great bear." Chapter 30. Pen Ormsford, his parents, Kyber Alessadil, and Tagwin descended through the corridors of Paranor to the furnace room, then back down along the hidden passageway that led to the outside world. They encountered no one on their way. The silence of the Druid's Keep was deep and pervasive, and gave the false impression that it was deserted save for them. But once they were outside, they heard the sounds of the battle being fought at the north wall, and although they hadn't seen the trolls arrive, they could pretty well guess at what was happening.
"That will give Shadea something else to think about,"
Tagwin grunted, a smile on his bearded face.
"Kermadec won't rest until he has the Ardris safely out of there."
That knowledge seemed to give him some sense of peace, and he quit muttering about how he should be back in the North Tower trying to help her. Pen was grateful for that, because, given that he was the only one sympathetic enough to permit it, most of the muttering was being done in his ear. While he appreciated Tagwin's concern for his mistress, he was struggling with his own problems. Pen was beginning to contemplate in some detail the task that lay ahead of him. He had thought he would be safely out of danger once he returned to Paranor with his aunt, so the news that he must go off and find a changeling demon and confront it with a dark wand had come as an unpleasant surprise. Once again, he was being asked to do something without being told exactly how he was supposed to do it. Only this time, he was being asked to confront a very dangerous creature. It was one thing to go into the Forbidding and bring back the Ardris, who was ready and willing to come. It was another to force a demon to go back into a place it did not wish to go. At least he had his parents to help him, and Kyber as well. They were much more self-possessed and experienced than he was. His father and Kyber had the use of magic as well. That should give them an edge once they found the demon. Still, it was his responsibility to use the dark wand to return the demon to the Forbidding, and no amount of reassurance could disguise the fact that he didn't know how to do that. As they moved away from the base of the cliffs on which Paranor rested, slipping quickly and quietly into the forest towards Swift Shore, Pen found himself wondering what demons were like. He hadn't really seen any in the Forbidding, unless you counted Weka Dart, and he didn't. The Ulk Bog didn't seem like a demon to him. He envisioned demons as being something much more fearsome and threatening. In any case, he didn't know what he was going to do once he met a real one, but he thought it might be a good idea to figure out something before the moment arrived. They passed through the trees to the clearing where Swift Shore was tethered, climbed up the rope ladder, and set about releasing the anchor ropes. His parents did most of the work, his mother taking the helm and his father working the lines. In minutes, they were airborne, lifting away from the woods, rising swiftly into the air. He stood with Tagwin and Kyber at the railing and looked down on Paranor. The north wall of the Druid's Keep was under attack by huge numbers of rock trolls, their size and build unmistakable from any height. The trolls were spread out all along the wall, but the greatest number were bunched together at the gates, and from the surge pushing inward, it seemed clear that the gates had been taken. Then, Swift Shore was moving away too rapidly for them to follow the action below any further, and Beck was calling out to Kyber as he moved toward the ship's bow. The trio moved away from the railing in response and joined the elder Ormsford in front of the foremost. Will you use the elf stones now? He asked Kyber.
What am I looking for?
She already had the stones out and was holding them in the palm of her hand.
I don't know what a demon looks like. I don't know what sort of creature I ought to tell the stones to find.
Perplexed by the problem, they stared at each other in silence for a moment. None of them, after all, had ever seen a demon or had any clear idea of what one looked like. If they didn't know what they were looking for, how were they supposed to find it?
Then Penn said, Try holding on to the staff, Kyber. It helped me find Grianne in the Forbidding. If its purpose now is to find the demon, it might help you here.
He handed her the dark wand, which she took from him and held out in front of her in one hand while gripping the elf stones in the other, summoning their magic. The moments crept by. Nothing happened.
It isn't working, she said, a hint of panic in her dark eyes.
Penn took the staff back from her.
I guess it only responds to me. Let me try. If it showed me how to find Grianne, it should show me how to find the demon as well.
He gripped the dark wand and turned his thoughts to the demon and the forbidding. Instantly, the runes began to brighten all up and down the length of the staff, their glow soft at first and then building in intensity. When they began to dance off the staff like fireflies, Penn said quickly, Now, Kyber, put your hand over mine and use the elf stones. She did so, gripping the staff with her left hand and lifting her right fist to call forth the magic. The response was immediate. The elf stones brightened like blue fire, their light flooding from between her fingers in brilliant shards and exploding away toward the southwest. The light showed miles and miles of plains and hills, green expanses of grasslands and farms, then tightened to a point where a single airship sailed steadily west across the landscape. The craft was huge, a great warship, its decks thick with the black and silver uniforms of the Federation, but stripped of any visible weapons. The vision tightened and settled on one man, an imposing patriarch with flowing white hair and a strong, imperious face, who stood in the pilot box as if to oversee its workings, his arms folded across his chest as he stared off into the distance where the thick forests of the Westland spread away from the broad, gleaming surface of a sunlit lake. Seconds later, the image flared once and went dark. And the magic faded.
Send Dunsadan,
Tagwin declared, loathing in his voice. Then he realized the implications of what that meant.
Shades!
He breathed, his face going pale.
You're sure about this?
Beck asked, putting a hand on the dwarf's broad shoulder. Tagwin nodded firmly.
There's no mistaking him. He's come to Paranor enough times that I should know him. Prime Minister of the Federation, but a snake of the First Order. I would have been willing to bet everything I own that he was Shadea's ally in sending the Ard Rhys into the Forbidding. He's always hated her, ever since she manipulated him as the Ill's Witch. She made it up to him, but he never forgave her. He isn't the type to forgive anyone.
But now, he's the demon? Rue interrupted. What's going on?
Beck shook his head.
The demon crossed over when Grianne was sent into the Forbidding. It must have taken another form right away. It probably switched identities more than once. Now it pretends to be Sendunsidan. A good choice. It gives the demon tremendous power.
It's going into the Westland, Kyber said. That lake was the Mirian, and those forests... The turfing. It must think it's found a way to destroy the Elcries.
Beck nodded. Flying west below Callahorn, away from the Preken Doran and the normal routes of travel. It's trying to sneak in from below. It knows it will be seen eventually, but perhaps not right away.
It must have a plan for what it will do when the elves intercept it. Negotiation first, perhaps, then force if all else fails. That warship looks formidable, even if it doesn't seem to be carrying any weapons. There must be something aboard that will allow the demon to destroy the Elcries. The elves will never let it get close enough to threaten the tree, Kyber insisted.
Not if they know it is a demon, but as Sendunciden, it will get closer than it would otherwise.
At any rate, we have to stop it. If we fly all night, we should intercept it by dawn. I might remind you, said Rue Meridian, who had come up quietly behind them while they were discussing what to do, that we don't have any weapons on this ship except for a pair of rail slings. How are we supposed to intercept anything? Penn's father didn't seem to have an answer to that, saying that he would think about it.
Beck went back with Rue into the pilot box, leaving Penn with Kyber and Tagwin. Unable to get past his susceptibility to air sickness, even on the calmest of days, the dwarf was already starting to look a little green, and after grunting something about taking a nap, he disappeared below. Penn talked with Kyber for a time, catching up on what had happened to her after he had gone into the Forbidding, and telling her in turn what he had seen there. When they were finished with that, neither one wanted to talk about much of anything. They were exhausted from their struggles and in need of nourishment and rest. Kyber left to find something for them to eat, and Penn moved over to the bow and settled in. Looking out over the countryside, he thought anew about what he was going to do when they found that warship and its demon commander. He was aware of how uncertain things were becoming once again, and the particulars of his own role in what lay ahead were the most nebulous of all. He had survived the Forbidding and a good deal more, but that didn't make him feel any better about his chances. He wished he had some idea of how the Dark Wand would work on the demon, but there was no one to tell him, and no way for him to find out until the moment he was using it. He wasn't very reassured. He found himself thinking about his aunt. Events at Paranor were in all likelihood already over. She had either regained control of the Druid Order, or she was dead. He didn't want to think like that, but he knew it was true. Thinking of what they had left her to face made him sick at heart. She seemed so frail and so vulnerable that he couldn't conceive of her surviving a battle with the rebel druids. He told himself that she had survived in the Forbidding, so she might find a way to survive at Paranor. It would have been better, though, if they could have stayed to help. It would have been better if she weren't so alone. Kyber returned with food and drink, and after Penn had consumed both, he went below and slept. His sleep was deep and untroubled, until sometime around midnight, when he dreamed of a dark presence enfolding him so tightly that he couldn't breathe, and he woke, sweating with fear. After that, he didn't sleep at all. It was 2 hours past dawn when the Morik saw the other airship approaching. By then, the Zolomach had turned north along the silver ribbon of the Myrmidon and was approaching the Valley of Wrenn on a day that was bright and clear and warm. The Morik didn't care what kind of day it was. It only cared that it was to be the last day it would have to spend in an unpleasant world. It hated the brightness and the smells. It hated the humans it was forced to live among. It was worse aboard this airship, where it was in proximity to them all the time and could not escape to its sewer refuge. Worse still, it had assumed the identity of a human who was never left alone for more than a few moments, even when sleeping. It couldn't change the conditions of this world quickly enough, but time was running out on the Morik. In spite of its success in avoiding detection by elven airships, the atmosphere aboard this vessel was poisonous. 2 days earlier, the Freeborn Army had overrun the Federation defensive lines on the Precandoran and sent that once seemingly invincible force fleeing back into the deep Southland in a reprise of what the Federation had done to the elves some days earlier. Matters had turned about completely, and there was no changing them back. All attempts at rallying the remnants of the battered Southland army had failed, and the war, after decades of indecision, had turned decisively in favor of the Allied Freeborn. The Coalition Council was furious with Sin Dunsadan and had summoned him to appear before it, but the Morrick was no fool. It knew, as Sin Dunsadan would have known, what that summoning meant. So it simply ignored the council, boarded the Zolomach, and set sail for Arbalon. Its own plans were settled and in no way affected by anything that had happened on the Precandoran. Those aboard ship knew of their army's defeat, but had been assured that what they were doing would carry the war to the elves and turn things around. They accepted that because they were soldiers, and because they had no choice. No one wanted to question Sin Dunsadan, even when he was in disfavor with the Coalition Council. Sin Dunsadan had come back before. There was no reason to think he would not come back again. They had been forced to travel cautiously, choosing a route that would keep them from being spotted by freeborn airships and would get them close enough to Arbalon and the Elcries that the Morrick could implement its plan to get closer still. In a way, the defeat of the Federation army on the Precandoran had made its task easier. When finally intercepted by the elves, the demon would say, in its guise as Sin Dunsadan, that it had come to discuss a plan for peace, to accede to conditions that would assure that the war would not resume. It would ask permission to fly to Arbalon to speak to the Elven High Council. It would give assurances that no treachery was intended and offer hostages as a show of good faith. It would demand that they let it remain aboard the Zolomach, because, in the face of so many of the enemy, no right-thinking commander would leave the only protection available. The elves would accept his condition. The Federation ship would display no weapons and pose no visible threat. They would feel confident that they could deal with anything the Prime Minister might attempt. If persuasion failed to win them over, then the demon would use the fire launcher, which was concealed inside what appeared to be a storage cabin on the foredeck. In the event of an attack, the front section of the cabin could be dropped away and the weapon armed and fired in seconds. The elven airships would be burned out of the sky before they knew what was happening, and the Zolomach would continue on its way. Once within the range of the Elcries, a single direct hit was all it would take. It would be over before the elves had a chance to do anything to stop it. In spite of having the fire launcher, the Zolomach would be destroyed and its crew killed in reprisal, but the demon would escape because it would shed Sin Dunsadan's skin and take a new form. In the chaos, it would slip over the side of the ship. Once it was on the ground, they would never find it. But now, an unfamiliar airship was approaching, and they were still too far away from Arbalon for it to be an elven vessel. It was flying alone as well, which suggested it had another purpose. The demon watched it grow larger, closing steadily, in no apparent hurry and with no indication that it meant any harm.
"Captain," the demon said to the tall man on his right, "what ship is this?"
The Zolomach's captain, who had been studying the vessel through his spyglass, shook his head.
"No ship I know. Not a ship of the line, not a warship."
He looked again.
"Wait.
Her insignia is of a burning torch on a field of black," he trailed off.
"She's a druid ship."
The Morrick stiffened.
"Shadea Aru?
Come looking for him out here? The idea seemed preposterous."
"Who's aboard her? Tell me what you see."
The captain put the spyglass up again and studied the ship.
"Two druids standing at the bow. A pilot. Someone else. A boy, it looks like.
Let me see."
The demon took the spyglass from the captain and scanned the decks of the approaching airship. It was just as the captain had said. Four figures were visible on deck, and no one else. No railguns were mounted, and no other weapons were to be seen. The demon lowered the spyglass and made a quick scan of the decks of the Zolomach. Reassured by the presence of Federation soldiers at every turn, there was no reason to be worried. Still, it was uneasy. What was a druid airship doing way out there by itself? It was not there by chance. The encounter was not a coincidence.
They're signaling to us, the captain advised.
The demon glanced over at him in confusion.
Signaling?
The captain pointed to the line of pennants being raised along the other ship's foremast.
They wish to come aboard and speak with you. See the pennant with the silver and black on it? That's your pennant, Prime Minister. They must know you are aboard.
The demon's first impulse was to turn on the approaching airship and attack it at once. But the demon was trapped inside Sendunsidan's skin, and an unprovoked aggression against an ally would not be well received by the officers and men who crewed the ship. Worse, it might result in a battle they could not win. Although the druid airship was not armed, the druids themselves were formidable. If they were to damage the Zolomach and force another delay, it might prove fatal to the demon's plans to reach the Elcries. White, hot fury fed the Morix's sense of frustration, but it kept calm outwardly. It would have to deal with the situation in a diplomatic way.
Move alongside them and ask what they wish to speak to us about, he ordered.
The captain raised his own line of pennants, then maneuvered the Zolomach until she was close by her counterpart. The druids stood at the railing, black cloaked and hooded. The Morric glanced at the name carved into the ship's bow, Swift Shore.
Sendunsidan, shouted one of the druids, the taller of the two, a woman by the sound of her voice. She kept her hood raised. Shadea Aru sends greetings.
The Morric felt a twinge of panic. If Shadea had sent this ship and these druids, then nothing good could come of it. After all, the Ard Reese had already tried to kill it once. There was nothing to say that she was not about to try to do so again. But then, the demon remembered that it was no longer in the guise of Iridia Ileri, and it was the sorceress whom Shadea had sent assassins to kill. Sendunsidan was Shadea's ally. So far as the demon knew, nothing had happened to change that. It calmed itself.
What does Shadea wish of me?
It shouted back, in Sendunsidan's deep, resonant voice.
How can I be of service to the Ard Reese?
She wishes to be of service to you, the speaker replied. She wishes to present you with a gift that will be of use in negotiating with the elves. She knows of the disaster on the Preken Doran and wishes to mitigate the consequences. May I come over and present it?
The Morric had no use for such a gift, but it understood that it could not afford to cast aside the offer out of hand. To do so would look suspicious. Worse, it would suggest that its motives in coming to the Westland were not peaceful. Shadea had allied herself and the druids with Sendunsidan and the Federation. It made sense that she would want to aid the Prime Minister in his efforts at resolving the Federation dispute with the Freeborn. She was as much at risk in this business as he was. The Morric wondered fleetingly how she had found out about where Sendunsidan was going and why. But it assumed she had spies at Arishag who told her everything. The Morric steeled itself. It would have to suppress its impulses and act as Sendunsidan would. This would only take a few minutes, and then it could be on its way. Better to placate the druids than to irritate them.
Let them aboard, Captain,
it said to the Zolomach commander, but watch them closely in the event this is something other than what it seems. The captain nodded wordlessly, and the Morric climbed down from the pilot box and walked over to the railing to await its visitors.
It won't work, Penn kept thinking. It will never work.
But it did. He could scarcely believe it when the Zolomach's captain ran up the line of signal pennants that invited the druids aboard. He had been convinced that permission would be refused and they would be turned away without a second thought, but his father, who had conceived of the plan during the night and worked the details through carefully with his mother, had assured them all that the demon would relent. In its guise as Sendunsidan, it would be forced to do what Sendunsidan would do. It might want to turn them away, but it would realize that to do so would create suspicion and risk disruption of its efforts to reach the Elcries.
Its overriding goal was to reach Arbalon as quickly as possible, Beck reminded them. It would do whatever was necessary to make that happen. Under his father's steady hand, Swiftsure eased closer to the Zolomach, and lines were thrown from the latter to the former and secured by Penn to the anchor stanchions so that the two vessels were joined. Penn glanced up and down at the soldiers lining the other ship's railings and tried to reassure himself that they didn't matter, that the plan would work out as his father intended. His mother and Kyber, cloaked in the druid robes his mother had stolen from Paranor and stowed aboard some weeks earlier, stood together at the bow, waiting, patiently. They kept their hoods up and their features concealed. Sen Dunsadan didn't know any of them by sight save Tagwin, who was hiding below decks. But it didn't hurt to be cautious. As he finished tying off the lines, Penn went over in his mind one last time the details of what was about to happen. If they were mistaken in any way about how the Dark Wand would react, or if his aunt had guessed wrong about what he needed to do, or, worst of all, if the King of the Silver River had deceived his father in his fever dream, then none of them were likely to return from the Zolomach alive. But it was mostly up to him to make the plan succeed, and it was his own judgment that was likely to determine how things turned out. His mother and Kyber were moving along the railing toward the ramp that had been lowered from the Zolomach to allow them to board. Unbidden, he fell into step behind them, carrying the dark wand in his right hand, the almost black, rune-carved surface gleaming in the sunlight. He sensed Sen Dunsadan's gaze, his demon's gaze, drawn to it. Cold and dead as deep winter, those blue eyes flared with sudden interest, and Penn felt a chill run up and down his spine. Fighting down his repulsion and fear, he took a deep, steadying breath and stepped up onto the ramp behind his mother and Kyber as they walked slowly across to the other vessel. His father stood silently in the pilot box, showing no particular interest in the proceedings, a mercenary paid to do his job. But he would have already summoned the magic of the wish song, and be holding it at his fingertips, he would be watching carefully for any sign of treachery. Penn paused to glance down. Below, the countryside spread away in a broad tapestry of mixed greens and mottled browns. They were several hundred feet in the air, suspended above the world with no place to run, trapped if things went wrong. But things would not go wrong, he told himself. He tightened his resolve and moved quickly off the ramp and onto the Zolomach's decks. Federation soldiers and crew surrounded him, crowding in until there was nowhere left to stand. Seeing what was happening, Kyber lowered her hood to reveal her elven features, glanced disdainfully at the men, made a quick warding motion with one hand, and watched in satisfaction as they fell backwards like stalks of grass in a heavy wind. Only the demon was left untouched. It smiled Sen Dunsadan's smile, gave Kyber a small nod of approval, and came forward until it was only steps away. The smile froze. We have not yet met. Kyber bowed. I am a servant to my mistress, Shedea Aru, the true Ard Rhys. My name is of no consequence. Shedea sends greetings and asks that you accept her gift of this staff. She would have come herself, but her presence at Paranor is required while matters remain so unsettled within the Order. She sends my sister and myself in her place to offer reassurances of her commitment to the Federation. The staff is a demonstration of her support for your alliance. She gestured dramatically past Rue, who was still cloaked and hooded, to where Penn waited with the dark wand. As prearranged, Penn lifted the staff and held it out so that it could be clearly seen. The staff, Kyber said to the demon, whose eyes were riveted on it, has a special use. She nodded to Penn, who turned his thoughts to the forbidding and the creatures that lived within it, At once his connection with the staff took hold and the runes blazed to life, a crimson glow that was blinding even in the bright morning sunshine. He saw that glow mirrored in the demon's gaze, hot and intense. Kyber stepped close to the demon so that only it could hear. The staff gives the holder the ability to command the attention of all who come into its presence. You can see that this is so. It also gives the holder small insights into the thinking of those with whom he negotiates, a window on their attitudes and concerns. It can be useful in knowing how best to persuade. By now, images of the runes were dancing off the staff in wild patterns that flitted in the air all about Penn. The Federation soldiers and crew muttered excitedly. The demon blinked, and its eyes took on a new look, one both hungry and anticipatory. It wanted the staff. It needed to possess it. "Will you accept my mistress's gift?" Kyber pressed gently. Saint Dunsadan's anxious features tightened, and the demon's eyes glittered. "I would be honored to accept it." Kyber looked once more at Penn, who came forward obediently, eyes lowered as much out of fear for what was about to happen as for the demon itself. When he got to within 3 feet, he stretched out his arm and canted the glowing staff toward the demon. The demon reached for it and then, for just a second, hesitated. Penn felt his heart stop. Then Saint Dunsadan's face broke into a broad smile, and his fingers closed about the staff. From the moment it saw the staff, the demon knew it had to possess it. It was not a rational craving. It was a compulsion that defied explanation and transcended reason. It was so overpowering that the demon barely heard what the druid was saying as she explained the staff's uses, and when the boy held the staff forth and the runes carved into its burnished surface flared with hypnotic brilliance, the demon was lost. The staff must be claimed. The demon was its rightful owner and must possess it. Nothing else mattered, not the destruction of the Elcries, not its plans to bring down the Forbidding, nothing, even so. It hesitated for just a second when the staff was extended, a glimmer of suspicion aroused by the recognition of the intensity of its inexplicable attraction. But it took the staff anyway, and the moment it did so, it realized it had made a mistake. The runes blazed like tiny flames as the demon's hand closed about the carved wood, and another kind of fire exploded through the demon in response. It was a fire of possession, of transference, and of magic, a fire meant to cleanse and to purify. The demon felt it instantly and tried to pull away, but its fingers would not release. They had taken on a separate existence, and no matter how hard it tried to loosen its grip, it could not. It screamed then, a sound that rent the air and caused even the most hardened of the Federation soldiers to shrink away. It threw back its head and shrieked its defiance and fury. Some among the crew, the captain included, came racing to its aid. The demon lashed out in response, its claws splitting the concealing skin of the human fingers, slashing and tearing at them until they fell bleeding on the deck of the airship. The boy still gripped the other end of the dark wand, eyes wide and staring. He knew something of what was happening, the demon saw. Enraged, it snatched at him, trying to draw him close, but the boy ducked away, and one of the druid women shouted at him to let go of the staff. They understood what was happening as well, the demon realized. It stumbled toward them, its limbs leaden and unresponsive, filled with the fire of the magic, throbbing with the molten heat of its workings. The boy backed away, stubbornly keeping hold of the staff, and finally, the taller of the women flung herself atop him, dragged him to the deck, pried loose his fingers from the staff and pulled him clear. Instantly, the light of the staff bloomed until the demon was enveloped by its glow. It fought furiously to free itself, slamming the staff against the deck, twisting and flailing futilely. The skin of the human Dunsedain split wide, and the clothes of the human Dunsedain ripped and tore. Both fell away, leaving it fully revealed. Gasps and sharp hisses issued from the mouths of all who saw what it was, and there was a rush of booted feet on the wooden decks as men fled in all directions. The demon would have given chase. If it could have, it would have ripped their throats out. It would have drunk their blood. But it was consumed by its struggle with the staff and could do nothing but thrash and scream its hatred of them. Then the light closed about it completely, and the world it had sought to subvert, together with the inhabitants it had come to despise, disappeared. The demon felt a crushing pressure on its chest and fought to breathe. It felt a shifting in time and place, and realized in horror what was happening. It was going back into the forbidding, back into the prison from which it had escaped. It was being returned to the world of the Jarkarus, a victim of the staff's magic, and there was nothing it could do to prevent it from happening. It fought anyway, shrieking and spitting and thrashing, an insane thing, right up until the moment it blacked out. Aboard the Zolomok, Federation soldiers and crew alike stared in shocked silence at the space Sendunsedain, or whatever had played at being Sendunsedain, had occupied only seconds before. Nothing remained but blood and shredded clothing and pieces of skin. None of them knew what had happened, and most didn't care to find out. All they wanted to know was whether there was any risk that the thing that had been the Prime Minister of the Federation was coming back. Kyber swept the air in front of her with a sparkle of elemental magic to gain their attention, black druid robes billowing out. "Back away!" she shouted at them, moving forward threateningly, occupying the space directly in front of what remained of Sendunsedain. She glanced down at those remains, and then up at dozens of frozen stairs. "You didn't want him for a leader anyway, did you?" Rue Meridian was hugging Pen, her face fierce. "What were you thinking, Pendaren?" she whispered. "It would have taken you with it if I hadn't broken your grip on the staff." Pen was white-faced, both from the pressure of his mother's grip and the realization of how narrow his escape had been. He took a deep breath. "I wasn't sure what would happen if I let go." She hugged him tighter still. "Well, whatever the reason, you hung on too long to suit me. You scared me to death." "I wonder if it worked," he said softly.
"You wonder if what worked?"
"Something I tried, right there at the end. The staff and I were joined, we were communicating. I was telling it things. I was trying to make it understand me."
He drew back and looked at her.
"That was what I was doing when I was hanging on, before you made me let go." "Trying to tell the Dark Wand something?" He smiled and nodded. "But I don't know if it understood."
It took a while for the Morrick to regain consciousness after its struggle to resist being sent back into the Forbidding. As a result, it did not see the bright images projected into the air by the runes of the Dark Wand as it pulsated with light on the barren ground next to it. It did not see those images rise skyward to form intricate patterns that danced across the sullen clouds. By the time the demon stirred, the images had faded, and the fire had gone out of the runes. The Morrick sat up slowly, knowing at once from the taste of the air and the smell of the earth that it was back inside its prison. It stared down at the staff, The once gleaming surface had become dusty and scarred. The runes had gone dark, and the magic had disappeared. It was just a length of wood, a useless thing. When it became aware of the shadows looming over it and looked up to find the dragon, the demon had to stifle a gasp. A huge, scaly, armored monster. It was easily the biggest the demon had ever seen. Freezing in place, the demon tried to figure out what to do, casting about in vain for a way to escape. The dragon was studying it intently, its lidded yellow eyes gleaming with a strange fascination. And then it saw that the dragon wasn't looking at it, but at the staff that lay at its feet. The demon snatched up the staff and held it out to the beast, offering it eagerly, but the dragon didn't move. It was waiting for something. The demon laid the staff close by one of its huge, clawed feet and started to move away. But the dragon hissed at it in warning, freezing it in place. The Morrick turned back slowly, not knowing what to do, unable to determine what it was the dragon wanted. The dragon, in no hurry, waited for the demon to figure it out. Chapter 31. The day was drenched in sunlight, and from high in the air where she rode aboard the druid airship Bremen, Grian Olmsford could see the countryside for 50 miles in all directions. Huge, cottony clouds floated against the western horizon, far out on the flats of the Strelaheim, distant and remote, a soft promise of good weather. The airship sailed north on the first day of its expedition, and the woman who had once been Ard Rhys of the Third Druid Order was at peace. She had known for a long time what she would do, she supposed. She had known from before she had come back through the forbidding what must happen. The Order would never heal while she was Ard Rhys, no matter how much she wanted to make it well, no matter how hard she tried to mend its wounds. The past is always with us, and more so with her than with most. She had accepted that she would never be free of that past. She could chart the important phases of her life, as a child of 6, hiding in the cellar of her home with her baby brother, while her parents were slaughtered in the rooms above. As a young girl subverted by the Morgor into believing that the druid Walker Beau had been responsible. As the Ill's Witch, working to destroy Walker until a chance meeting with the brother she had thought dead revealed the truth, and as Ard Rhys of the Third Druid Order, struggling to find a way to gain acceptance as a force for good within the Four Lands. She could see the path her life had taken and comprehend the reasons for all that she had done, but she could never explain it satisfactorily to anyone else. She could try, but most would dismiss her words as clever attempts at self-justification, or worse. She understood the truth of things. Some would always see her as the Ill's Witch, and would worry that beneath the surface of the image she projected, a monster lurked. That would never change. The roots of mistrust had grown too deep. Trant Rowan had been right about that. Had he been more patient and less foolish, he would have lived to see her admit it. She glanced back at the pilot box, where one of Kermadec's rock trolls stood at the helm. Kermadec himself was seated on a box below the side wall, deep in conversation with Penderin. She wondered what they were talking about. Even in the short time since the big troll's recovery from the battle in the North Tower, the two had grown closer. After returning the Morrick to the Forbidding, the boy had come back to Paranor with his parents and had remained to help her restore some semblance of order to the druid's keep. His parents had stayed too, for a little while, but they had grown uncomfortable, as they always did with Paranor, and, seeing that she had matters well enough in hand and missing their home and their old life, they had decided to go home to Patch Run. But Penn had stayed on. His friendships with Kermadec, Taguin, and Kyber Elesidil influencing his decision at least in part. All were aware of the transition Grian was working. All were anxious to help her see it through. Penn could do no less, he told his parents. Beck understood. Rue accepted. They made him promise he would not stay past the end of the month. They wished Grian and the others well, said goodbye, and flew Swiftsure home. Grian never told them all of what she intended, although she would have liked to tell Beck. But it was best if she didn't, she told herself. It would be easier on them if they didn't know. She had dissolved the order and dismissed those still in her service. As Ard Rhys, she had the power to do this, and there was no one who would question her now. She gave Paranor into the keeping of Kyber, Belezen, and Trefin Maurice. When the time was right and when they had found a way to do so, they would reform the order. A handful of others who had remained loyal were invited to stay as well. But she charged the three she trusted most with spearheading the task of carrying on, the ones she believed would work the hardest. All three had asked her to reconsider. All had pleaded, inexperience and limited skills, they were not equal to the task, others could do better. But there were no others she could rely on, and there were covenants to monitor, a part of the agreement that she had forged with the Federation and the Freeborn. Her young successors would struggle at first, but they would learn from their mistakes and they would grow from their experiences. They would survive, protected as they were by Paranor and their magic, by the mystique of the Druids, and by their own perseverance and determination. She had thought this through, carefully, after talking with each. It was the right choice. In the end, persuaded that she would not accept their refusals, they had acquiesced. They would select those men and women who would make up the next generation of druids at Paranor. Perhaps, in time, the governments and peoples of the four lands would come to accept them as a good and necessary force for the furtherance of peace and cooperation among the races. Certainly they would have a better chance of achieving that goal than Grian did. Just then, the elves and the Federation were in the difficult process of putting themselves back together. Arling Elessadil would serve as queen regent until her eldest daughter grew to adulthood and assumed the throne. There was a rumor she would remarry and seek to put a son on the throne instead, but she would never permit her daughters to follow in the footsteps of their father and grandfather. She was a strong-willed, at times intractable woman, and she did not look back fondly on her marriage to Kellan Elessadil. With the war on the Precandoran ended, she was seeking ways to assure that madness of the sort he had displayed as king would never happen again. She would never achieve that goal, of course. Perhaps she knew that. But it did not stop her from trying. Battered and disheartened by their defeat on the Precandoran, the Federation had withdrawn its armies, ceding to Calahorn and its people the lands to which it had laid claim during the war. After more than 30 years, the Southlanders had lost their taste for fighting a war that had netted them nothing. Sen Dunsedain was dead, and a new prime minister ruled the Coalition Council, a man who did not favor expansion as a goal and war as a means to an end. His people appeared to agree. There were those on both sides who believed that the war should be fought to the bitter end, those who would never accept any resolution short of victory on the battlefield, but they represented a small minority. A peace accord was swiftly brokered. The threat presented by the deadly fire launcher was blunted, at least for the time being. As a condition to the peace she had brokered between the Federation and the Freeborn, Grian had won a single concession. There would be no further use of diapson crystals in the making of weapons. Diapson crystals would be used to power airships, and that would be all. The last fire launcher had been destroyed. The man who had invented it had disappeared and was believed dead. And his plans for building other weapons had been lost in a fire along with his models and designs. She had made certain of those things. She had assured herself that the matter was settled. Her price for winning the agreement and assistance of all parties in enforcing covenants regarding the future use of diapson crystals was her promise to relinquish her place as head of the Druid Order. Those who sought that did not know she had already made the decision to step down. It did not hurt to let them believe they had been responsible for persuading her. They were as frightened of her as they were of any weapon, and the bargain was easily struck. She could not know if the bargain would be kept, but for the moment, at least, there was a fresh outlook in the governing bodies of the races, and a chance that common sense might prevail. Her successors would do their best to see that it did. Tagwin would serve as their advisor. Kermadec, who had reformed the Druid Guard from among his own people, would see that they were protected. It was as much as anyone could hope for. It was the best she could do. Aunt Crianne? Penderyn stood at her elbow. She gave him a quick smile, her reflections and musings scattering like dust motes. It's a beautiful day, Pen. Perhaps that is a good omen. He smiled back guardedly. Do you really think you can do something to help? He asked. Do you think there is a chance you can get her back?
I think maybe there is. Don't you?
He bit his lip. I think that if anyone can do it, you can. That is high praise coming from a boy who found his way into the Forbidding and back again. She paused. Perhaps when we get there, you will discover that you don't really need me after all, that you can do this by yourself. She saw the unsettled look that crossed his face.
No,
he said. I've seen what's down there, how she's bound by the tree roots with the others. I don't think I would be strong enough to free her on my own. They were flying to Stridegate and the island of the Tanaquil, where they would attempt to reclaim Cinnaminson. She thought that perhaps she had made the decision to do so even before coming out of the Forbidding, that she knew even then that she owed the boy that much. She understood from what he had told her how much the girl meant to him, and how hard it had been to give up trying to free her and come looking for Grianne instead. That sort of sacrifice deserved more than a simple thank you. She had waited until things were settled with the Order, and the treaties between the Federation and Freeborn signed before acting. She had waited until his parents had returned home. It wasn't that she didn't think they would support their son's efforts to free Cinnaminson. Indeed, they would want to help. But making the attempt was something she had decided she must do with Penn alone, for reasons she had kept to herself. Only Kermadec and his trolls were invited to come along. She put a hand on Penn's shoulder. "You are a lot stronger than you think," she said. "I want you to remember that. Don't make the mistake of underestimating what you can do." He shrugged. "I'm not very strong, really." He hesitated. "I think that you are wonderful for doing this. I won't ever forget, even if we don't get her back." She almost hugged him, but couldn't bring herself to do it. She had been distanced from others for too long, and although she might feel affection toward them, she was not comfortable with demonstrating it. She still saw herself as an outcast, as someone who didn't really belong anywhere and would never be close to anyone. Worse, she saw herself as dangerous, more so since the events that had taken place inside the Forbidding. The workings of the Wish Song's magic, when she had transformed herself into a fury, and when she had destroyed the Gromph, had left her shaken. For the first time since she was a child, she was uncertain of the magic. Something about it was changed, perhaps still changing, and she was not sure how well she could control it. She looked off into the horizon.
"Strength comes to us through belief and determination, Pen. The trick is in recognizing how to use it."
"You've done that better than I have," he said quietly. She glanced over at him and smiled.
"How I wish that were true."
The gravediggers arrived around midday on their way south, and the old man invited them to eat with him. He set out ale and cheese and bread, and sat with the three men around an old wooden table that occupied one corner of the porch, and looked out over the fields of wheat he farmed as his family had farmed them for five generations.
"How is it up there?"
he asked, after food and drink were consumed and the men were smoking. The stocky one shook his head.
Bad. A lot of bodies. We did the best we could, along with the others, but they'll be finding the bones of those we missed for years.
At least it's over,
the old man said. The tall one shook his head in reproof.
Should have been over years ago. Didn't accomplish anything, did it? Years and years gone and nothing's changed, except a lot of good men are dead.
And women,
the stocky one added. The tall one grunted.
Treaty with the Freeborn gives us just exactly what we had before the war started. The only good thing that's come out of all this is we have a new Prime Minister. Maybe he won't be as stupid as Sen Dunsetan was.
He looked at the old man.
Did you hear what happened with that one?
The old man shook his head.
I heard it from one of the soldiers on the Zolomach. He was there and saw it all. They were flying Dunsetan to Arbralon, maybe to make peace, maybe not. There's some debate.
They had that weapon aboard, the one that shot down the Elven King and his whole fleet. Anyway, some druids intercepted the ship. One of them had a staff with markings that glowed like fire. Soldier who told me this said Sen Dunsetan couldn't take his eyes off it. The druids offered it to him, but when he took it, he changed into some sort of monster. Split right out of his skin, like a snake, then disappeared. No one's seen him since.
Druid magic at work there,
the stocky one declared softly.
More of it later, too, if you ask me. The Zolomach sailed back to Arishag, was there maybe a day, caught fire and burned to her keel, everything destroyed. Took that weapon with her.
A fire took the place where they built that weapon and the plans for it, too, the tall one said.
Nothing left but ash and smoke.
You're right about those druids. They were involved in it. Happened right after the witch reappeared. They thought she was gone, but she won't ever be gone, that one, not her.
What is it they called her before she was Ard Rhys?
Ill's witch.
She comes back and all this happens, not by chance, I don't think. Doesn't matter what you or I think, the third man said. What matters is that the war is over, and we can get on with living our lives. There's been enough madness. I lost a brother and two cousins out there on the Precondor, and everyone lost someone. For what? Tell me that. For what?
For Sen Dunsetan and his kind, the stocky man declared. For the politicians and their stupid schemes.
He took a long pull on his ale.
This is good,
he said to the old man, smiling.
Good enough to help me forget the smell of all those dead men. Can I trouble you for another glass?
When they were gone, the old man went back into the house, pulled aside the rug to the storm cellar, and let the two elves out. They'd been hiding down there for several weeks, too damaged at first to do much more than sleep and eat, and then too weak to travel. He'd nursed them as best he could, using the remedies and skills he had acquired from his mother when she was still alive and working the fields with him. The man was the worse of the two, shot through with arrows and cut with blades in a dozen places. But the woman wasn't much better. He'd helped them because they were hurt, and that was the kind of man he was. The war on the Precondoran was not his war, and not his concern. No Federation war ever had been.
They're gone,
he said, as the two climbed back into the light. Pied Sanderling glanced around, and then reached back for Troon's hand. The day was clouded, but warm and calm, and it felt good to come back into the light. The old man brought them up whenever it was safe to do so, but that hadn't been often until now. They all knew before the treaty what would happen if they were caught out.
Did you hear what they said?
The old man asked them. Pied nodded. He was thinking of those who had gone with him into the Federation camp. He was thinking that their efforts had been worth something after all. The tide of war might have turned on the destruction of the Dectera and her deadly weapon. 24 hours later, Vadenwick had broken the siege, counterattacked, and driven the Federation off the heights. In the end, the Freeborn had prevailed. Now, it seemed, any danger of fresh weapons of the sort the Dectera had carried was ended as well. If the Druids had intervened, the chances were good that whatever remained of those weapons had been hunted down and destroyed.
Set. I'll bring you a glass of ale,
the old man offered. He had saved their lives. He had cared for and protected them while they recovered. He had asked nothing about them, nothing from them. He had been kind to them in a place and time when some would have wished them dead, and worked to make the wish a reality. They were elves and enemy soldiers. The old man didn't seem to care. They took chairs at the table while the old man brought the glasses and set them down. When he left to feed the animals in the barn, Pied looked at Troon. "I guess it's finally over." She nodded. They were mirror images of each other, their faces cut and bruised, their limbs bandaged, and their bodies so sore that every movement hurt. But they were alive, which was more than they could say about any of the others who had gone with them that night. They would have been dead too, if not for the old man. He had been burning off a field he had partially cleared, the fire still bright even after darkness fell, and they had honed in on that beacon. The old man had seen the flit come down, found them in the wreckage, and taken them in. He had thrown what remained of the flit into the fire, and then lied to the Federation soldiers who came looking the next morning. Neither of them knew why. Maybe he was just like that. Maybe, like the gravediggers, he'd had enough of war. "We can go home now," he said to her. She gave him a bitter smile. "To Arbalon? Where Arling is queen?" She was reminding him that he was forbidden to return to Arbalon, that Arling had dismissed him from her service. They stared at each other wordlessly. "Let's not go home," she said finally. She held his gaze. "Let's go somewhere else. They think we are dead. Let's leave it that way. Have you anyone waiting for you?" He thought about Drum for a moment and shook his head. "No." "Nor I." She took a quick breath and exhaled sharply. "Let's start over. Let's make a new home." He studied her face, appreciating the straightforward, uncomplicated way it revealed her. With Troon, there was never any question about what she was feeling. Certainly, there wasn't any question there. She was in love with him. She had told him that night on the flit. She had told him any number of times since. The revelation had surprised him, but pleased him, too. Eventually, while they recovered from their wounds, he realized he was in love with her, too. She reached out for his hands and took them in her own. "I want to spend the rest of my life with you, but I don't want to do it in a place that reminds me of the past. I want to do it where we can start over again and leave behind what we've known. Do you love me enough to do that?" He smiled. "You know I do." They smiled at each other across the table, sharing feelings that shouldn't be put into words because words would only get in the way. They set the Bremen down in the gardens that fronted the bridge to the island of the Tanaquil, anchoring her well back, but safely within walking distance. Stridegate's ruins were empty and still on an afternoon filled with sunshine and blue sky. They had flown into the Inkrim that morning, sailing out of night's departing darkness into dawn's bright promise, the boy and she standing together at the bow and looking down at the world. They had not spoken a word, lost in their separate thoughts. She thought she could probably guess at his, but that he could not possibly know hers. The Urdas were not in evidence on that visit, but Kermadec and his trolls kept careful watch for them, even after they were anchored and on the ground. Urdas would not enter the ruins, it was said. They would not come into any place they considered sacred. Kermadec was taking no chances and sent scouts in all directions with instructions to make sure. Grianne turned to him. "Keep watch for us, old bear," she said with a smile. "This won't take long." He shook his great, impassive face in disagreement.
"I wish you would let this wait for a while longer, mistress. You have been through too much already. If there is a confrontation down there—"
"There will be no confrontation,"
she said quickly, putting a reassuring hand on his armored wrist. She glanced over to where Penderin stood at the bridgehead, looking over at the island. "This isn't to be an encounter of that sort." She took her hand away. "You were the best of them all," she told him. "No one was more faithful or gave more to me when it was needed. I will never forget that." He looked away.
"You should go now, so that you can be back before dark."
There was resignation in his eyes. He knew.
"Go, mistress."
She nodded and turned away, walking over to join the boy. He glanced at her as she came up beside him, but said nothing. "Are you ready?" she asked. He shook his head. "I don't know. What if the Tanaquil won't let us cross?" "Why don't we see?" She walked out onto the bridge, the boy following, and called up the magic of the wish song, humming softly to let it build, working on the message she wanted it to convey. She stopped perhaps a quarter of the way across until she had it just right, then released the magic into the afternoon silence and let it drift downward into the ravine. She gave it the whole of what she thought was needed, taking her time, content to be patient, if patience was what was required. It was not. A response came almost immediately, a shifting of heavy roots within the earth, a rustle of leaves and grasses, a whisper of wind, voices soft and lilting that only she could hear. She understood what it meant. "Come, Pen," she said. They crossed untroubled to the other side of the bridge and walked to the trail that had led the boy into the ravine weeks earlier in his search for Cinnaminson. The island forest was deep and still, the air cooler, the light diffuse, and the earth dappled with layered shadows. She watched Pen cast about, eyes shifting left and right, searching. He was looking for the Aeriads, but she already knew they would not come. Nothing would come to them now. Everything was waiting. They found the trailhead and stopped. The path wound downward in a steep descent that gradually faded into a mix of mist and shadows. It was so dark within the ravine that they could not see the bottom. It was the sort of place she had entered many times. It was a mirror of her heart. She turned to him. "You are to wait for me, Pen. I will do this best if I am alone. I know what is needed. I will bring Cinnaminson back to you." He studied her face carefully, unable to keep the hope from his eyes. "I know you will try, Aunt Grianne." She reached out impulsively and hugged the boy. It was something she had seldom done, and it felt awkward. But the boy was quick to hug her back, and that made her feel better about it.
"Be careful," he whispered.
She broke away, moving slowly down the trail toward the shadows. "Thank you," he called after her, "for doing this." She gave him a small wave in response, but did not look back. The afternoon eased toward evening, and the light shifted and began to fade. Pen stood until he grew tired, then sat with his back against an ancient trunk, staring down into the ravine, keeping watch. He listened for sounds he did not care to think of, too carefully, but no sounds came. Silence cloaked the ravine and the forest, and for all he knew, the entire world. He watched patterns of light and shadows form and reform, slow-moving kaleidoscopic images against the earth. He smelled the scents released into the air by the forest and the things that lived there. He rubbed the blunted tips of his damaged fingers and remembered how they had gotten that way. He remembered what it had felt like to become joined to the Tanaquil through the carving of the runes. He remembered night in the island
forest and his terrifying encounter with Aphasia Y. Mostly, he remembered Cinnaminson. He could picture her face and the way she smiled. He could remember the way she moved. He could hear her voice. She was there, alive and well within his mind, and it made him want to cry for his loss. But he smiled instead. He knew she was coming back to him. He believed in his Aunt Brienne. He had faith in her magic and her skills, in her promise that she would find a way. He loved Cinnaminson, although he had never loved a girl before and had no frame of reference from which to draw a comparison. But love seemed to him to be a state of mind peculiar to each, and there was no set standard by which you could measure its strength. He knew what he felt for Cinnaminson, and if the difference between what he felt when he had her with him and when he did not was an accurate measure, then he could not imagine how love could be any stronger. Time slipped away, and at last, when no one had appeared and darkness had begun to close about, he found himself wondering what he would do if his aunt failed and Cinnaminson didn't come back to him. He dozed then, made sleepy-eyed by the warmth and brightness of the late afternoon sun slanting down through breaks in the branches of the trees. He did not fall deeply asleep, but hovered at the edge of wakefulness, arms about his drawn-up knees, head sunk on his chest. Eyes closed. He drifted. Then, something stirred him awake. A whisper of sound, a hint of movement, a sense of presence. And he looked up to find Cinnaminson standing before him. She was more ghost than flesh and blood, pale and thin, and disheveled in her tattered clothes. He got to his feet slowly and stood looking at her, afraid that he was mistaken, that he might be hallucinating. "It's me, Pen," she said, tears welling in her eyes. He didn't rush to her, didn't grasp her and hold her close, although he wanted to do that, to make certain of her. Instead, he walked up to her as if time didn't matter. He took her hands and held them, studying her face, the spray of freckles and the milky eyes. The musty smell of earth and damp emanated from her body, and tendrils of root ends still clung to her arms. He reached out and touched her face. "I'm all right," she said. She touched his face. "I missed you. Even when I was one of them and thought I couldn't possibly be happier, I remembered you and missed you. I don't think that ever would have stopped." She put her arms around him and held on to him as if she was afraid she would be taken away again, and he could feel her crying against his shoulder. He started to speak, then gave it up and just hugged her, closing his eyes and losing himself in the warmth of her body. "Who was it who came down for me?" she asked him finally, her voice muffled. She lifted her head from his shoulder, put her mouth close to his ear. "I don't understand it," she whispered. "Why did she do it? Why did she trade herself for me?" Penn thought his heart would stop. In the air above them, the Aeriads hummed and sang and danced on the breeze, invisible and soundless. Heedless of time's passage, they played in the soft glow of the sunset's red and gold and the evening's deep indigo. They were spirits unfettered by the restrictions of the human body and the limitations of the human existence. They were sisters and friends, and the whole of the world was their playground. One strayed momentarily, the newest of them, looking down on the young couple that stood at the edge of the ravine and spoke in soft, comforting tones, their heads bent close. The girl was telling the boy about her, and the boy was trying to understand. She knew it would be hard, that he might never come to terms with what she had done for the girl. But she had done it for herself, too, to give herself a new life, to set herself on a different path, to be reborn. She had known what she would do almost from the time the boy had spoken of the girl's transformation and of her joy at what she had experienced. She had wanted that for herself. That the boy and the girl would make a better life together than apart was incentive to take the chance. Offer herself for the girl, a woman not so young, but deeply talented and magically enhanced, a creature Mother Tanaquil could not help but convert. The trade was simple. The change of places was done in a heartbeat, and a small balance to things was set in place. "Come, sister," the others called to her. She lingered a moment longer, thinking of what she had given up, and finding she had no regrets. There was nothing of her old life that was so precious to her, nothing so compelling as even the first few moments of this new one. Too many years of struggle and travail, of heartbreaking loss and back-breaking responsibility, of failure, ruin, and death, had marked the path of her life. She would never escape from it in human form. She knew that. She accepted it. But as a creature of the air, she had left it all behind, a part of another life. She watched the boy and the girl turn away and start back through the woods toward the stone bridge. Maybe they would find in their lives something of what she had failed to find in hers. She had already found something precious in her new form, something she had not known since she was 6 years old and living still in the house of her parents with her baby brother. She had found freedom. This is Paul Bamer.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.